Hi Jay.
Hi, Avi, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Sorry for the delay. The previous interview took longer. I was telling the person that I have another one, but it just took a few minutes longer. I'm sorry about that.
Oh, don't you worry. It's not a problem at all. Happy to be here with you, and I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me.
My pleasure. We can start whenever you want. And how long do you expect it?
Well, we can aim for an hour, and then if you're okay with maybe a little bit of spillover, I'll try and be as succinct as
That
possible.
should be
But
fine. And let me just double check what I. Yeah, that should be no problem. I have another interview coming, but it's in a couple of hours. So,
my goodness, busy day for you then, yeah?
no, it's sort of typical. I had 2,000 over the past year. I had 2,000 interviews. So.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Well, I can't boast that amount of numbers just yet. So 2000 is pretty impressive. But yeah, no, I'm really, really happy to have you here. And definitely an exciting moment in history for a conversation that has experienced decades of ridicule. Having serious academics and scientists like yourself take a keen interest in understanding this phenomenon. I mean, it's certainly laying down the necessary framework for a wider level of engagement on this issue. And before we jump into the Galileo project specifically, I'd just like to ask what first got you interested in UFOs in general?
Well, as an astronomer, I studied the early universe, the first stars, and then black holes. And in those areas of research, when you see something unusual, it's very common to suggest possible explanations, some of which are not proven, but the idea is it would motivate collecting more data and evidence that would educate us about what reality is like. For example, we don't know what most of the matter in the universe is, and it's a different form of matter than we are made of, and it's some type of particles we've never figured out what their nature is. And so there were suggestions for types of particles that may be the dark matter, and experimentalists went out and searched for them and didn't find them. So for 40 years we've been doing searches for the dark matter. We haven't found it, but that's the way science is done. We are sometimes searching in the dark, and I came up with that notion of the way scientific research is done. And then in 2017 there was this object, the first one detected from outside the solar system that came close to Earth. And even though it was the first one, it looked very unusual. When you go down the street, you expect to see a person that is sort of typical, but if the first time you go down the street, you see something really unusual, that raises a red flag that maybe you don't understand reality correctly. And that's pretty much the experience I had, that this object had a lot of anomalies, didn't look like a rock we have seen before in the solar system. And it was the first from outside the solar system. And in my book, Extraterrestrial, I talk about the various unusual facts about this object. And all these facts were collected from data assembled by telescopes, in the standard way. And even the mainstream astronomers who try to explain those anomalies, they had to come up with an object of a type that we've never seen before. And that to me reminds me of a cave dweller that finds a cell phone and says, because he's used to playing with rocks all of his life, says it's a rock of a type that I've never seen before. And to me, it illustrated the fact that we must leave on the table the possibility that it was artificial in origin. And actually, in September 2020, there was another object that showed some of the anomalies of this first object. Then it turned out to be a rocket booster from a 1966 launch by NASA. And it was also, it didn't have a cometary tail, didn't it was pushed away from the sun by reflecting sunlight, just like this first object, Oumuamua, was. And to me, it illustrated the fact that it could have, Oumuamua, this first object, could have been artificial in origin. And that's what led me in the direction of actually proposing to date the next Oumuamua. It's just like going on a date. You meet a person that is of interest, but then by the time you realize it, the person is gone. And in the case of Oumuamua, now it's a million times fainter than it was close to the Earth. So we can't really see it anymore. And so we should date the next one and bring a camera close enough within 1,000 kilometers or so that we can take a close-up photograph of it, because they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. And in my case, it's worth 66,000 words, the number of words in my book. And it's not a philosophical question what this object is, whether it's natural or artificial. It's a question to which we can find the answer by taking a megapixel image of this object. And then the other thing that intrigued me was the report of the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, delivered on the 25th of June, 2021 to Congress, in which it was stated that there are lots of objects flying in the sky to which the government doesn't have a good explanation. And, you know, former CIA directors, Brennan and Woolsey, spoke about those objects, and former Director of National Intelligence, John Ratcliffe, spoke about the satellite data that may indicate something unusual, and former President Barack Obama and former Senator Bill Nelson, who heads NASA, also said that scientists should now get engaged. And that motivated me to consider establishing a project, scientific research project, that will assemble new data. And I tried to approach NASA and see if they are, I told them, you know, I would be glad to make your boss happy if, but I didn't get a response. And then a few multi-billionaires came to the porch of my home, and they were inspired by my book, Extraterrestrial, about this object, Oumuamua. And they provided about $2 million to my research funds at Harvard. And at that point, I said, okay, I can establish this project, the Galileo Project, we called it. And the goal is twofold. One is to take a photograph of the next Oumuamua. And the second is to figure out the nature of those unidentified aerial phenomena that the government talks about.
Have you had any resistance to the creation of the Galileo Project? I imagine maybe from the wider scientific community itself, perhaps even from some government channels. Has there been any sort of notable resistance?
No, I should say that I didn't hear anything from Washington, D.C., except there was the amendment proposed by Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, which mentioned the Galileo Project by name. And I never spoke with her, and I never lobbied for the project, but she nevertheless mentioned it. And that amendment ended up in a legislation by Congress to establish a new office in government that will coordinate the data assembly from all sections of government about UAP, unidentified aerial phenomena, and we'll deliver reports to Congress about it. And that office was signed into law by President Biden, and will start operations in June 2022. And it will presumably keep all the classified data still classified, so we won't have access to it. But it's good that it will be established, because first, it will coordinate the assembly of data, and second, it will remove the stigma from this subject, and this subject will be taken more seriously now that money is allocated, you know, in government. And so I didn't hear from the government, and frankly, I don't want to look at classified data, because it would limit my ability to function as a scientist. I want the data that I analyze to be open, and I don't want to be limited in the way I can speak about it. And the sky is not classified. It's just those instruments that were used by the government to collect the data that are classified. So in principle, we can look at the sky with off-the-shelf instrumentation that the Galileo Project is putting together. And in fact, we are assembling the first telescope system on the roof of the Harvard College Observatory in the coming months, in the spring of 2022. And that includes cameras in the infrared that would take a video of the sky at all times, and also in the optical band. And so that would allow us to monitor objects both during daytime when they reflect sunlight, and also nighttime when they just emit infrared radiation because they're warm. And And then we will also look at them at the radio band and in the audio sound waves that they produce. And there will be an artificial intelligence algorithm that will try to figure out whether an object is a bird, a drone, or an airplane, or something else. And once the entire system works to our satisfaction, hopefully by summer 2022, we'll start making copies of it and placing them in different geographical locations. And the number of copies depends on how much funding we have. So with the current funding, we'll be able to make maybe 5 to 10 copies, but the goal is to get $100 million such that we will have hundreds of them. And then we will get a good census of the sky and get good statistics of these unidentified objects. Now, in parallel to that, we are also partnering with Planet Labs, which has, it's a company that has a fleet of 210 satellites that get an image of the Earth once a day, the entire Earth, with a resolution of roughly twice the size of a person, 4 meters or so. We will try to look at unidentified objects from above, not just from below. And that will be very interesting to see how it unfolds. So actually, that might be the first data set that we'll have our hands on. So altogether, you know, we have that program, but we're also designing a mission, a space mission that will bring a camera very close to the next Oumuamua. And that is a completely separate program because it's more expensive to send a space mission. It's roughly $500 million. And also it takes much more planning. Whereas for the UAP, we pretty much are hitting the ground running already now.
I think it's important what you said about the congressional interest versus the scientific interest, because I see it very much the same as you. It's an incredible step forward that there's bipartisan support for this issue within Congress. But I find that what that will do more than anything else, rather than bringing out amazing information for all of us to pore over, I think it's going to help dissipate that stigma, help dissolve down that stigma. And I put a lot more faith in the grassroots scientific community to actually then take interest in this and bolster that research effort and have a more transparent level of a conversation come from, you know, areas that aren't restricted to non-disclosure agreements and aren't restricted to top secret sensitive information. So I think that's a very important thing going forward with this. And
And I should add to that, you know, the stigma and the ridicule within the scientific community is problematic because, you know, people say extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. But it's a circular argument, because if the study of this subject is being ridiculed, then nobody is searching for that evidence. And my statement is that extraordinary evidence requires extraordinary funding. You need people to look at that, and one should be open-minded. And the strange thing is, the government is the most conservative organization we have, and yet it allocates funds towards this study. And why is the academia lagging behind? You know, that's an interesting question. It's supposed to be more open-minded. And obviously, if some objects are of extraterrestrial origin, it's not a national security matter. It's an international matter. And that is the focus of science, and science should be open-minded. So if the government says we don't understand something and the public says we are really interested in this something, then I think it's the obligation of scientists to engage in that and clear up the fog. Now, it's possible we put out a fishing net and we might catch only sardines, you know, things that are like, we will find out that all these objects that we find are explained as natural objects or as human-made objects. You know, it's possible. We will report whatever we find. But even in that case, it's a very important thing to do, because by clearing up the fog, you basically say, let's move on. You know, instead of scientists ridiculing it and then the public speculating about what it might mean and the government being confused, even if the contribution of the Galileo Project would be simply you know, to figure out what these things are. And even if they are natural or human made, we just explain that. That by itself would be a major step forward in the sense of let's move on and talk about other things. You know, let's not waste time on this. Now, I should also say that it's enough to have one object of extraterrestrial origin, you know, and even if it's a mixed bag and most of the objects are not really of interest.
We only need one. We only need one.
You only need one. And the only way to find whether there is such an object, because there is this sense by many people that argued for years that there are some strange objects out there. It's quite possible that most of these strange objects were, you know, either employed by the military and the civilians who saw them, didn't really understand where they come from. It's also possible that many of them were natural, but and it's really a mixed bag. Most of the objects have mundane explanations. But that, you know, so it will not be a vindication that indeed all these reports were correct, because many of them may be related to human-made objects, okay, and or meteors. You know, if you see a meteor and you think, oh, it comes from space, it's unusual. But my point is, you know, if there are things coming from an extraterrestrial origin that are equipment that are artificial in origin, we find only one of them. That by itself is a major advance in our knowledge, and it will change our perspective and will change the future of humanity.
Very well put. Another very interesting addition to the Galileo project is the legendary computer scientist and one of the godfathers, really, of UFO research, Dr. Jacques Vallée. And, you know, since he's been brought on as part of the research team rather than simply just an affiliate, I imagine he has a specific role, serves a specific function. Can you expand on the role of Dr. Jacques Vallée in the Galileo project?
Well, the people that work in the research team are mostly scientists that have a PhD, and they have a contribution in terms of the science that we plan to explore. So, you know, in his case, he is well known for his work on the subject in the past and knowledge and insights about the physics involved in the search. And like all members of the research team, he provides ideas and insights about how we should proceed. But if you look at the membership of the Galileo project, you will find that it's a big tent that includes both the skeptics and advocates for an extraterrestrial origin. And the reason I brought those communities together is because it shouldn't really matter. The evidence should educate all of us, and it's a learning experience. You know, that we should always approach science as a learning experience. We should be modest. We shouldn't pretend that we know more. You know, one of the most traumatic experiences I had as a child was to ask a difficult question at dinner, and then the adults in the room would dismiss it because they didn't know the answer to it. And so I pretty much prefer to stay a kid and not pretend that I know the answer, and basically be guided by evidence. And that's the way science should be done, without prejudice. And I brought people that with different opinions, because I think at the end of the day, it will, you know, if we get a megapixel image of an object that looks different than a natural rock, that looks different than a natural phenomena, that appears to have bolts and screws on it, and there is even a label saying made on exoplanet X, you know, then it would become obvious that this is not the natural. So it really doesn't matter what your prejudice is, what your first opinion is. And the same is true if we find that it's all natural or human made. You know, it's always possible we miss something, but the point is that at least we will put limits on how frequently such things that are unusual take place. And so altogether, it will be the evidence that will decide, you know, what conclusions we arrive at. And I actually prefer to have people with opposite opinions to start with, because then if we converge, it will become clear that we didn't miss anything. You know, if people with different initial opinions come to the same conclusions, that's a triumph for science. And, you know, I asked, for example, Michael Shermer, who is the editor of a magazine called Skeptic, who is a member of the Galileo team. I said, suppose we get a megapixel image of an object that looks artificial and not from this Earth, and what would you do? And he said that he would report about it in his magazine, Skeptic. And I said, well, I'm not happy with that. I would prefer that you change the name of the magazine from Skeptic to Believer at that point. So it's really all about the evidence. And I'm completely agnostic about that. So I just like a kid that wants to figure out the truth, you know. And I think speculations are not necessarily helpful, because then the scientists look at the speculations and say, well, you know, these are not substantiated, therefore we shouldn't even pay attention to it. Well, if we collect within the Galileo project, we collect the data in the standard scientific way with instruments that we fully understand, that we assembled. They are not reports by eyewitness testimonies. They are reports based on measurements. And then we write scientific papers. That would bring the subject to the mainstream of science. Mm. We hope. And actually, the only people that can object to the project are those that do not follow the scientific method. You know, there are people that prefer not to follow the scientific method. I'm actually surprised that some of them are scientists, call themselves scientists, because you shouldn't stick to an opinion or a prejudice. You should say, oh, actually, it's great that there is a project that will try to collect evidence. And in fact, it's even greater because it's not using funds that were allocated to other projects in science. So I think all scientists should rally behind this project because it follows the scientific approach to a subject of great interest to the public and of great interest to the government. What could be better than that?
Yeah, I'm glad you clarified the perspective on this, because I put out a tweet before we jumped on record just to see if anyone had things they wanted to ask. And there were a few people, and these are people within the UFO community, who actually expressed a little bit of concern about kind of the Galileo project bolstering its ranks with people that could be called, like, quote unquote UFO personalities, or, like, you know, a skeptic would just say, oh, they're just a believer, you know, they're not objective. And there were a few concerns around that, but I think that you've pretty much answered the question I had down for you already, where you're bringing together these two, you know, opposing sides and trying to bring them together under the common banner of curiosity and exploration, basically.
And also, I think, you know, it demonstrates that science is a learning experience, where we now have on record what their initial opinions are. And then suppose we get high quality evidence or data, they might change their opinion. And that would show you the power of science, of evidence. You know, if someone looks at a megapixel image of an object, you know, it's really difficult to deny. And that someone knows how the data was assembled. And this data can be reproduced because you can look again, you know. At that point, you know, people will agree what it means. And I'm an optimist in that sense, because if people with different initial opinions agree, it shows that science is a learning experience. That's a very important aspect of science, that you're not supposed to know the answer in advance. And if you are a philosopher during the days of Galileo Galilei and you say, I know that the Earth is at the center of the world, you know, and I don't need to look through Galileo's telescope, and then you put Galileo in house arrest, and if he were alive today, you would have canceled him on social media just because he has a different opinion. That's the wrong approach. Why do I call it wrong? Because if I were to ask that philosopher who, you know, put Galileo in house arrest, if I were to ask that philosopher to design a rocket that would reach Mars, he would never succeed in building a rocket that would reach the destination, because his idea was that Mars moves around the Earth, which is not true. So he would send a rocket, it will never get to Mars, and then eventually we'll realize, oh, maybe Galileo had a point here. The Earth is not at the center. Now, of course, that would be a learning experience for that philosopher. And the philosophers might decide not to do that, not to learn from experience, but that's their problem, okay? Because NASA, all the agencies that try to launch rockets by now realize the truth, that the Earth moves around the sun. The fact that those philosophers argued otherwise 4 centuries ago didn't matter. Nobody remembers them. And the same is true about whether we have neighbors. You know, you can sit at home on the sofa and say, I don't hear a knock on the door. I don't have neighbors. Forget about it. It's an extraordinary claim to say that there is someone outside of this house, because I look around and I see only myself in this house. Now, the mistake you're making is that in order to find your neighbors, you need to look through your windows. The chance of them knocking on your door is really small. They don't do it very often. And not only you need to look through the windows, but better with telescopes. And if you don't understand that, you will never collect that evidence. You would argue that it's an extraordinary claim. But the truth of the matter is, it will not get rid of your neighbors. The fact that you don't see them doesn't get rid of your neighbors. And if we want to understand reality, the reality that we live in, we really need to collect data. You know, you can put goggles on your head and live in the metaverse, you know, and there you would be at the center of the universe. You will have ideas about virtual reality that flatter your ego. You could look much better than you look in actual reality. You know, you can always look slim and attractive, and you are at the center of the world, and everything is good and happy. The only problem is it's not the actual reality that all of us share. It's in your head. And I mean, the purpose of science is to figure out the nature of the reality that we all share. You know, that's my duty as a scientist, because, and that's an important point, we can all be happy living in the virtual reality by putting goggles. We can all be happy like those philosophers that didn't want to look for Galileo's telescope. But if you understand the actual reality that we live in, you can use that knowledge to your benefit. You can build rockets that will reach Mars. You can, you know, develop mRNA vaccines. You can, all the accomplishments, you can build gadgets, you know, that we are using on a daily basis, like those goggles that you put on your head. So all of these things would not be possible if we were to shy away from the task of understanding the reality that we live in. If we were to live in the virtual realities that flatter our ego. And that's my criticism of people that insist on the notion that it's an extraordinary claim and that we shouldn't fund any search for others in our cosmic neighborhood. Because I do feel that over and over in history, you know, we were proven wrong by arguing that we are privileged. We ended up not being at the center of the universe. We ended up figuring out that the Earth-Sun system is not special. Half of the Sun-like stars have a planet the size of the Earth, roughly at the same separation. So what makes us think that as intelligent beings, we are unique and special? It's this sense of arrogance. And I think we should rather assume, be modest and assume that everything we see around us is sort of typical. And most stars form billions of years before the sun. So Albert Einstein was not the smartest scientist that ever lived since the Big Bang. You know, there was another planet where a scientist smarter than Albert Einstein lived a billion years ago. And on that planet, the technologies that were developed may have reached us by now over a billion years. They may be everywhere. And the only way to figure out if we live in such a reality, it's not a philosophical question. We just need to look through our telescopes.
Well, let me lean more into the philosophical for a moment, because another aspect of the UFO issue that continues to fascinate me and evidently continues to fascinate some of the most prominent researchers, some of which you have now got on your team, is the interpenetration of consciousness into this conversation and how the UFO issue seems to represent, at least in my mind, and certainly I would say in Jacques Vallée's mind and some others, it seems to represent a sort of a symbiosis between physics and metaphysics, or material function and quantum function. And perhaps we could even say between science and spirituality, there seems to be a shared space. And even Lou Elizondo once said that he believes that the truth of this phenomenon lies within the nexus between consciousness and quantum mechanics. How much of an impact does consciousness or consciousness-related studies have on your team's interests with the UFO phenomenon?
Okay, so first let me say that I think there is a strong connection between spirituality and space exploration in general, because I attended a forum in the Washington National Cathedral on the 10th of November, 2021, and Jeff Bezos was there, and he was talking about the commercial benefits of space tourism and that he hopes that there will be a trillion people in space ultimately, and they would think of the Earth as like a national park that they go and visit once a month or something. But I was trying to think about it, and I realized that leaving the solar system has no business plan. There is no way you can make a profit out of leaving the solar system. So the only way that we will be driven to explore beyond the boundaries of the solar system is through a sense of spirituality, trying to figure out the unknown, you know, and trying to look beyond the boundary of our territory, which we were born into. You know, it's just like saying, okay, there is a street out there. I have my own property. There is a backyard, but let's go beyond that and figure out what's out there, because, well, maybe there are neighbors on that street. Maybe they're quite different. Maybe we can learn from them. So anyway, space exploration, fundamentally going well beyond where, you know, the vicinity of the Earth, should be driven by a wonder, sense of wonder about the unknown. And that's what spirituality is all about. Now, if you ask me about consciousness, my thinking is, you know, that it's an emergent phenomena. It's, we are made of atoms and molecules and, you know, things that are described by physics and chemistry. And of course, we are a very complex system. So consciousness is one of those phenomena that comes out of this complex arrangement of molecules. There is nothing beyond our physical existence. And in a way, when a person dies, it's just like unplugging a computer out of the outlet, you know. And so it's possible that in the distant future, we will have robots with artificial intelligence that we will connect to as if it's an individual with consciousness. I mean, they would look to us as if they have consciousness. I mean, the only consciousness we are fully aware of is our own. For other people, they just appear similar to us, you know, in the way they behave. So I think there is a possibility that in the future we'll have sufficiently sophisticated robotics and artificial intelligence to get the illusion or the impression that a system that was artificially made by us has some consciousness to it. And it's just a matter of the level of complexity and the abilities, mental abilities that that system will have. So in that sense, I don't think consciousness is anything new in terms of a component and a substance that is added to the atoms that we're made of. I think it's just a result of the fact that our brain is a very complex system, you know. And
see, I would disagree just only slightly on this, because I personally feel that perhaps consciousness could be seen as emergent, but perhaps also in some way fundamental, and that it's embedded within the evolutionary coding of the kind of substrate of our reality. And you look into quantum phenomena and non-locality, and perhaps there is it's like the receiver versus generator argument about the brain and whether it's a complex receiver. And
definitely, I mean, quantum mechanics and physics is the way we perceive the reality around us. And, you know, when you talk about the way we perceive the reality, it must be through the lens of the consciousness that we have, right? So when we talk about quantum mechanics and, you know, doing an experiment that changes the information we have about the system, and then the system has a wave function that collapses as a result of that, definitely it's entirely possible that we just didn't get to the bottom of the connection between our perception of reality and you know, and consciousness. You know, reality is not independent of the way we perceive it. It's all tangled together.
Right, but right.
What I was saying before is, it may well be that we don't have the correct understanding of quantum mechanics, but I don't think that we are anything beyond the physics that we are. You know, it's just like a complex machine. You know that. You don't fully understand, you know, like if you were to give a cell phone to a caveman, the caveman would never be able to figure out how the cell phone works. And yet we know that the cell phone is something you can produce, you know, out of a better understanding of physics. So I would argue that we are still early in the game of understanding the relation between reality and the way our brain works. Definitely agree with that. And quantum mechanics may be the indication to that, that, you know, quantum mechanics is still puzzling to physicists a century after it was realized. So we don't have a proper understanding of the foundation of quantum mechanics. And we know how to use it to build gadgets, but we don't fully understand it, philosophically speaking. And it reflects something about, you know, the fact that we don't understand our brain well enough. That may well be, but I don't think that, you know, it's just like the cell phone would still be a physical object, even though the caveman could not understand it. I don't think there is anything beyond that. And I don't think there is life after death, for example. I don't think there is a soul in the human body. You know, 1,000 years ago, people thought there is a soul, and therefore you should ban anatomy, because if you were to dissect the human body, you would hurt the soul of a person. So that there were people seriously believing that the human body should not be dissected. And I'm glad that eventually modern science decided to open up the human body, you know, and not listen to those people, because the only reason we have modern medicine, you know, fixing the bodies of people right now, is as a result of opening it and realizing what it's made of. And it was mysterious 1,000 years ago. And people thought, you know, there is something like the soul. And people had all kinds of ideas about how diseases are caused. And, you know, if you were to live 1,000 years ago, there would never be a cure or a vaccine to some illnesses. And gladly, we did open the human body and we figured out what it's made of, and we can fix things in it. And so I think the human brain is far from being understood, and perhaps our understanding of physics is limited by that, because after all, physics is the interaction of humans with the reality. But I don't think there is anything beyond the physical existence. That's what this is.
Well, you know, the spiritualists thought that if you cut the body open, you'd damage the soul. And scientists once believed that you could fall off the earth if you travel to the end of the ocean. So I think both sides have that dynamic of assuming that they're correct when perhaps they weren't. But I do find, just personally, that there is a fundamental mysteriousness to life. And if you pay attention to the kind of events and processes that you experience as a human being, that for me has given me that kind of underlying feeling that there may be more to life than just physical interactions, you know, and I think that's something that none of us can truly know until we close our eyes for the last time, right? None of us are ever going to know until we're on the other side of that, on the other side of that equation.
Well, you know, I'm turning 60 years old in a month, and I was thinking about my life and what are the biggest lessons that I learned. And I came up with three, only three. So the first one is, and that, you know, all three of them were things that I didn't follow until the last few years. So I was completely wrong on these three. So let me put them out there, because it's possible that other people also are wrong about this. So really, the way it seems to me right now is, you know, we live, and I realized it after both my parents passed away a few years ago. You know, life is very precious. We live for a short time. So the first thing is we should focus on the time remaining for us to enjoy, and not on past accomplishments. You know, we often tend to satisfy gatekeepers for some appointments, or to satisfy members of selection committees for honors, awards, and all kinds of things like that. And, you know, as I told the publicist of my book, after my book got published, Extraterrestrial, the heat that was generated turned my skin into a material like titanium. I don't feel any pain or pleasure out of what other people say about me. I don't really care about it. I don't care how many likes I have on Twitter. So instead of trying to impress other people and focus on the accomplishments of the past, you know, wearing medals from our past recognition, and you know, that makes you less ambitious. We should focus on the time that we have remaining and try to make the best out of it. Okay, so that's my lesson number one. And I didn't really follow it before. The second lesson is that we should start each day from scratch, you know, and without prejudice, without arrogance, without a sense of privilege. And that's important in the search for equipment from extraterrestrial civilizations, for example, because instead of feeling that we are privileged, that we are really the only intelligent species that ever existed since the Big Bang, we should start from scratch and basically say what we see around us is potentially typical, you know, and most stars from the, you know, billions of years before the sun, and there could have been another civilization that developed technologies that we are currently developing a billion years ago, and they may have sent crafts throughout the Milky Way galaxy, and maybe some of them are around us. We should check for that. And so we should start from scratch without any sense of arrogance or privilege. And the third item that, you know, third lesson is that money is only helpful in buying freedom, you know, and by that, what I mean is, you know, when I was younger, I had to worry about having enough money to have food, to have clothing, and to pay the rent. And once you get above a certain level of income, you don't have to worry about these issues. You know, nowadays I'm on a low carb diet. I eat the same thing every day. I cannot enjoy going to a restaurant more than the kind of food I eat regularly, and it's pretty much fixed. And so having more money will not change my diet. It will not change the bed I sleep on. It will not, you know, and, you know, most of the time people are driven by the goal to make more money or to purchase things, to possess things that are more expensive. To me, that's a distraction right now. You know, I want to have my freedom, not worrying about the bills that I have to pay, but at the same time, not worrying about how to make more money, not worrying about how to buy more things. So, you know, in a way, freedom is really what is the most precious thing. And actually, a lot of wealthy people are not free. You know, they have to worry about making, and they have to worry about huge number of people that are employed under them. And in my mind, they are not really enjoying life the way they could have. Because you can just sit on the beach and be free and just think about whatever you like. And, you know, who cares if you have billions or trillions? The point is that having that freedom of mind and not being worried about what other people say, that's another thing, that not subscribing to social media so much, not being being addicted to what other people think, is a sense of freedom. And it's nothing that money can buy. You know, you have to decide about it for yourself. And so this is the third lesson. It's just three lessons that I think are really important, and that it took me almost 60 years to learn.
Important life lessons from Professor Avi Loeb. We appreciate that. I think that's really, and I resonate very much with each of those. And, you know, it's funny with the billionaires, real quick, that I actually remember seeing a survey not that long ago, and they'd done a survey on quite a large number of billionaires, and the majority of them admitted they were incredibly depressed. You know, and I think it's exactly as you said, it's about enjoying the small things in life and being appreciative. And if you're continuously driven for more, that doesn't end. It doesn't end anywhere. You just keep going.
I rest my case. And by the way, it also applies to relations with people.
Yeah.
You always think the next person in line might be better than your current friends, that you want to, you know, reestablish relationships and so forth. You know, that's the wrong approach, because very often people change. And if you grow together with another person, that the person that you live with is not the same that you met originally. And so you can build up on the existing assets that you have rather than always change them.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, just enjoying life for yourself, not trying to get your satisfaction from other people approving you, is extremely important, because it allows you to be independent, to think critically, not to rely on the input you get from others. And in the context of unidentified objects, this is the most important thing, because, you know, the rest of the scientific community is currently arguing, ridiculing the subject, arguing that it's not worth studying. And it's a circular argument. And the only way to break that mold is to actually collect new evidence. And that's what the Galileo Project is doing. So I have the courage of leading it as a result of these life lessons.
Actually, I'd like to ask you in regards to like legacy efforts for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence groups like SETI. I'd like to get your thoughts on why America decided to spend millions of dollars of taxpayers and private contributors' money on efforts for the detection of radio wave signatures as a means of searching for intelligent life, especially when, you know, you juxtapose that method with the advancements we're making in quantum computation. It would seem an extremely archaic perspective to, you know, imagine advanced ET civilizations would be utilizing radio waves to communicate when we're already moving beyond such methods ourselves. So why has this been the go-to method for groups like SETI for so long, when it's yielded really no satisfactory results?
Right. That's exactly my criticism of the past approach. It started 70 years ago when there was a seminal paper by Cocconi and Morrison, who said, you know, radio communication is being used by humans. Let's check if there are signals from the sky. And that led to searches for radio waves, because they are easy to detect from large distances and relatively low power. And then the only problem is, it's just like trying to have a phone conversation. You need the counterpart to be active when you're looking. And most of the time, the counterpart may not be active. For example, we had communicated using radio waves just for 126 years since Guglielmo Marconi transmitted the first signal. And it's only one century out of 4.5 billion years, the life of the Earth. And it's also possible that, you know, we will develop other means of communication soon, that already, you know, just by using fiber optics for communication, we are removing and not trying to search for ballistic missiles with radio waves. We are already reducing the footprint of the Earth in the radio sky of other civilizations. And my point is that there is a very narrow window over which we were using powerful radio beams. And the chance of another civilization being exactly at the same technological stage as we are is quite small. And it is arcane, as you said, to look for things that we are doing right now. It's sort of like the question by Enrico Fermi 70 years ago, around the same time that this search for radio waves started. He said, well, if there are extraterrestrials out there, where is everybody? And again, it's just like a fisherman sitting on the beach and looking at the ocean and saying, where are all the fish?
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And that is the wrong question, because you need to use a fishing net. In the context of the search, it means using telescopes. And my point is, instead of searching for radio waves for another civilization using the same technology as we have, we should just search for objects, because objects keep piling up. You know, it's just like plastic bottles on the surface of the ocean. Over the billions of years that other stars existed before the sun came along, there may be a lot of plastic bottles out there with messages in them, and we just need to search. And their senders may not be around. We don't care, because you just find those bottles. Now, you may say, how do we know that it's equipment from another civilization? Well, it's very simple. It's the approach that Sherlock Holmes used. Basically, we eliminate the possibility that it's natural. We come close to it and we see that it's not a rock. Okay. In the case of objects like Oumuamua from 2017 that I mentioned, or in the case of unidentified objects in the atmosphere of the Earth, we see that it's not human-made. It's not a drone made in another country. It behaves in ways that our technologies cannot reproduce, and it's not a natural phenomena. So you basically eliminate possibilities, and then whatever you are left with, you know, that's what Sherlock Holmes said, whatever you are left with must be the truth. And in this case, it's something else from another civilization. If it's not natural to the vicinity of the Earth and it's not human-made, you know, someone else produced it. And then trying to figure out what it is a different task. But my point is, you don't need to know in advance that they're sending radio signals or that they're sending a spacecraft that looks just like Voyager. You don't need to know that. All you need to do is eliminate the options that it's natural or human-made. That's it. And once you do that, then you can start studying it. And for example, if it's still functional, and for example, if it has artificial intelligence, you want to figure out the intent of this equipment. You know, what is it? What kind of information is it seeking? How does it respond to our actions? And by the way, there is no protocol for dealing with such a thing, because in the past, SETI traditionally was talking about radio signals. So the nearest star is 4 light years away. It takes 8 years for a round trip of communication. And that's the nearest star. A star on the other side of the Milky Way galaxy, you know, communicates over timescales of tens of thousands of years. So there is no urgency in developing a response. You know, you can think about it and decide what to do. But if you have an object next to you, just like a visitor in your backyard, you have to decide immediately what to do about it and what its intent is. And so we don't have a protocol. There is nobody, no organization that represents Earth, and no decision about what to do if there is a piece of equipment that we find in our backyard. And that's another thing that needs to be dealt with. And we have, within the Galileo project, we do have a team, a subgroup that is thinking about it.
What would be your personal prerequisite for coming to the conclusion that we're in communication with extraterrestrial intelligences? What would you need to make that statement?
Well, it's very simple. First, I want to say that this issue is not a philosophical question. It's just a matter of, for example, getting a high-resolution image of an object that shows that it has bolts and screws and so forth. Now, it doesn't need to be functional. It could be defunct. For example, Voyager or New Horizons, you know, a billion years from now will be just space trash. So it's possible that space is full of trash, you know, and we can just find it. And Oumuamua, this object from 2017, was the size of a football field. NASA never sent a spacecraft the size of a football field. So it may well be that there are many more objects that are much smaller than a football field, and we weren't able to notice them because they're too small. They reflect very little sunlight, so our survey telescopes never noticed them. You know, only over the past decade, we built a telescope that can find an object from outside the solar system as big as a football field, so in the vicinity of Earth. So it's quite possible that there is a lot of trash out there. And that would mean that we will not communicate with it. We will just find it. If we find a plastic bottle on the beach, we know that it was produced artificially. It's not a rock. But we can't tell how long ago it was produced necessarily, unless there is a date on it. And we can't tell who produced it unless there is a label on it. So, you know, we have to look at it and study. And then in terms of contact, I don't think it will be biological creatures. If it is functional, it will be artificial intelligence because, you know, biological creatures were not designed to survive for long periods of time in space. You know, they are
unless they can do some sort of instantaneous travel and distance isn't a problem for them. Time and distance might not be a problem.
But we don't know of a way of doing that as of now. If it is possible, maybe they did it. And of course, one way to find out is to look around and see if they are out there. But if I had to guess based on what we know, based on what we are producing, I would say equipment with artificial intelligence. Now that can outsmart us, and it could be fully autonomous. I call these AI astronauts, you know, that operate on their own. They don't need guidance because the distance between stars, you know, is huge, and there is no point in such a system to wait for guidance about what to do. I mean, right now we have the Perseverance rover on Mars, and it does get guidance from engineers in the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, but that's just because the distance is quite small, and also we haven't developed yet AI astronauts. But in the future, I can see a future where we have equipment that is fully autonomous. It doesn't need any guidance from us. And it learns from experience through machine learning. So the way I think of it is as our technological kids that we send into space. And I'm very proud of that. I don't want to go necessarily to space on my own for a long trip. But I'm happy with sending AI astronauts that will fulfill the guidelines that they give them, just like, you know, sending your kids into the world. You know, for a while, you educate them, you give them the principles that you want them to abide by and the goals that they may have in life, and then you send them to the world. I'm not a, you know, a parent that overlooks what his or her kids are doing. I'm not a such a parent, and I enjoy having my daughters being independent, and I would be happy with sending those AI astronauts and being proud of what they accomplish in space. And I think that is pretty much the future of space exploration. It's not humans going, it's not Star Trek. I actually had an interview with William Shatner, because at this Washington National Cathedral event, Jeff Bezos said that he was inspired to develop SpaceX and space tourism by Star Trek, watching Star Trek as a kid. And I was sitting next to Avril Haines and the director of National Intelligence at the time that he said that. And I said, you know, I never found the storyline of Star Trek compelling or exciting because it violates the laws of physics as we know them. And she said, well, we have to work on you, Avi. And then I mentioned it in an essay that I wrote for The Hill. And the same day I got an invitation to speak with William Shatner. And I spoke with him and I said, look, William, you probably understand it the best, that the difference between virtual reality and the actual reality, because you played the role of Captain Kirk on USS Enterprise and in Star Trek for many years. And then half a year ago, you went on a vehicle that Jeff Bezos constructed to space. And you probably appreciate the difference between going to space in actual reality versus the virtual reality. And he completely agreed with me. He agreed that it's a very different experience.
With the 4 years worth of dissemination on the US government's internal interests with UFOs that we've seen occur pretty much since 2017, when the New York Times article came out, up to present day with all of the different changes, it's certainly opened the door wider in respects to looking at the US history on this issue and recognizing that there really has been a concerted and in some aspects possibly illegal effort to keep this subject out of the public perception, out of the scientific community for over 70 years. I mean, we're looking at seven decades worth of secrecy, perhaps even seven decades worth of clandestine research and development. How does it make you feel to know that scientific intrigue and exploration on a topic that has monumental, both scientific and philosophical consequences for the human race, has been suppressed for over 70 years?
Well, that's very unfortunate, because I do think that in order for us to learn about reality, we need to apply the scientific method where we collect as much evidence as possible. And if you ridicule the subject, then that evidence will not be collected. So we will not we will speculate and the scientific community will ridicule the subject, but we will not make progress. We will not know more. And the only way to know more is to be open-minded and just apply the scientific method and fund the search. Because in science, very often, you're searching in the dark. For example, we don't know what most of the matter in the universe is, the dark matter. And we've been searching for 4 decades for specific types of particles. We haven't found them. And so it's completely legitimate within the mainstream of science to search in the dark. And whatever you find, you report about. And the same approach should have been taken in this case. Instead, it was ridiculed and the public had to speculate. And that's not a healthy situation. You want to clear up the fog so that even if it's not, there is nothing out there, you know, and it can all be explained with mundane explanations. You know, that is a major progress if you were to say, okay, let's leave this subject behind us. We cleared up the fog. Now we know there is nothing out there that is of great interest and we just move on. But that was not done, as you said. And with respect to the government, I don't think, personally, I don't believe in conspiracies within government. I do think that the government is very often incompetent. That I do think. So it's possible that data was collected. And the reason it was not revealed is because it was collected by sensors that are classified. Okay, so the government is always trying to hold on to the data that it has, because otherwise adversaries, other nations will know what kind of instruments we're using to monitor the sky, okay, in the US. And that is completely understandable. So it's possible that those instruments picked up data on things that we don't understand. And, you know, it's not the role of government to worry about things we don't fully understand that are part of, you know, that are not part of national security. And then, of course, this report that came to Congress admitted that there are such objects that the government doesn't understand. So I think the government is sincere about it. There are things that look really weird, whose nature is unclear. And, you know, you need scientists to figure out what they are. And the politicians are not trained to do the job. And, you know, the military is really about defending the nation. And if you see things that do not belong to other nations, then it's not a matter of national security as much as it's an international matter. It's the kind of thing that scientists should be engaged in, okay? And that's where I think we are right now, that we are at a juncture where the Galileo project, you know, is the first well-funded project with more than 100 scientists that will address this subject using the scientific method by building instruments. And, you know, the observatories that astronomers developed in the past are not really suitable for this study, because if a bird flies above a telescope, then the astronomers ignore it. They focus on sources that are very far away. And in the Galileo project, we will follow that object. We will try to figure out whether it's a bird, a drone, an airplane, or something else. And that is a task that was never taken in the astronomy community. And therefore, we have to assemble our own telescope systems to build our software to analyze the data. And thankfully, now we have much better technologies that were not available 2 decades ago and during the days of Fermi 70 years ago when he said, "Where is everybody?" Now we have a much better fishing net than he could put his hands on. And so let's go and search and check. And it's really exciting. And science should be exciting. Science is not supposed to be boring. And I think there is a good chance we are taking a road that was never taken, you know, just like in the poem by Robert Frost. He said that it made all the difference for him. As far as I'm concerned, the main difference is that there is a chance for the Galileo project to find low-hanging fruit, because nobody took that path scientifically before. And the government may have seen things that look weird, but they didn't go in depth into studying them. So we will try to do that. And our data will be open and the public could look at it and anyone can analyze the data as they want. And, you know, we live in an exciting time, I think.
Well, I appreciate you not wanting to entertain, conspiracy theories, but I think, you know, it's fair to say the government has had its fair share of conspiracies, Iran-Contra, Watergate, Pentagon Papers. And this was actually something I wanted to bring up with you. And I know we're nearing the end, so I'll maybe ask one more question after this. But this is something I wanted to bring up with you. Because over the years, we've had some very interesting statements from incredibly high-level individuals on the topic of material acquisition and technological exploitation of non-human assets. In plain English, the issue of reverse engineering retrieved vehicles or technologies. And there are a few prominent examples of individuals that have strengthened this idea that perhaps non-human technologies are being studied in extreme secrecy within the world of, you know, clandestine black budget, that was not easy to say, projects and, you know, sensitive aerospace programs. So there is one example, Ben Rich, former director of Lockheed Martin's Advanced Projects Department, known as the Skunk Works. And he once said during a 1993 alumni speech at UCLA, "We already have the means to travel among the stars, but these technologies are locked up in black projects, and it would take an act of God to ever get them out to benefit humanity. Anything you can imagine, we already know how to do." So that's coming from one of the directors of the Skunk Works. Another prominent example is Admiral Bobby Ray Inman, former director of Naval Intelligence and the National Security Agency, deputy director of the DIA and the CIA, as well as later becoming the president of Science Applications International Corporation, SAIC. Now, he once acknowledged to a man named Bob Exler on the record back in the 1980s, and there is an audio recording of this conversation, but there were such programs in action that were dealing with retrieved or you know, non-human vehicles, but he highlighted his doubts as to whether these programs or these vehicles would ever come to light. And the last example I'll provide before I ask you my question comes from a colleague of mine, a very well-known Australian investigative reporter, Ross Coltart. He was very fortunate to connect with and meet a former director of the US Navy's entire science and technology division, a man named Nat Kobitz. He was unfortunately dying of cancer when he reached out to Ross, and he is sadly no longer with us. But Ross spoke with him multiple times and eventually asked Nat if he had ever been read in to UFO retrieval or reverse engineering programs, to which Nat acknowledged that he had, that he was aware of multiple craft being retrieved and studied, and that he'd better not say anything else because he was never read out of these programs. And he also did say to Ross that he was exposed to anomalous materials that seemed to share similarities with meta materials currently being studied by Gary Nolan and Jacques Vallée. So I guess you have kind of answered my question with your perspective on this, but just given the kind of credibility of these types of individuals, and there are other statements, do you think that there's a possibility that actually the US government does have these things and they've just kept it very tightly under wraps?
Well, everything is possible. You know, I respond to that in a similar way to my response to, you know, the classified data that we've never seen. I didn't see the classified data, maybe of much higher quality and very highly respected individuals that had access to that data, spoke about it as a serious matter. And of course, psychologically, that's very intriguing for me. And that's why I established the Galileo Project. But, you know, as a kid, I want to put my hands on something like that before I believe it. I want to see it. I want to use my instruments to detect it. I want to see it in front of me. And I haven't seen it. So all I can say is that it's very intriguing. And maybe it's true, maybe not. But we cannot rely on what people say because, you know, people sometimes have other motives. They can say things without justification. And the only way to figure out the truth is by reproducing it, by having physical evidence for it. Either you enter a room where you see it, you know, and or you can document it in a way that all scientists in the world will be able to reproduce it, okay? And we don't have that. So it's what we have is some people saying some things, and to me, it's not sufficiently credible. I mean, of course, it's
I think it's just taking into account their level of their bona fides and, you know, the type of career they've had. I think that I totally agree with you in terms of, you know, objective scientific data points. It's not something that can be quantified and put into practice, but it's
I wish we could have access to the actual physical evidence.
Oh, me too.
Until we, so it's the same thing with classified data in general. You know, the government may have exceptional data of exceptional quality, and as a scientist, I cannot really write a scientific paper or say wholeheartedly that I believe that what this data means, because in order for that to happen, I need to be able to apply my analysis to it. So if there is something physical, I want to be able to use instruments to measure its properties, to, you know, and just by people saying that it exists somewhere, that's not sufficient. Because science is about reproducibility of results. Now, it's possible that it's true, but if so, you know, if these objects exist out there and the government noticed them and the government even put its hands on some of these objects, as scientists, when we go out to those expeditions, we should see it. You know, we will find it. So just stay tuned. There might be low-hanging fruit if indeed it's common. And my hope is that we will be able to report back in a way that is transparent, not like those people who signed NDAs and cannot speak about it. So we need to bring some transparency to this subject. And, you know, there is no point in hiding the evidence if it affects all humans. It's not a matter of one nation versus another. You know, the way I think of it is, you know, when humans worry about national security, like there was a defense bill in the US for 2022 that was $768 billion, and it was dedicated to defending the US against other nations. And if you think about it, it's just like kids playing in a playground and trying to win in the game. But they're playing, let's say, with toys that look like cars. But then a real car appears on the street next to them, and it comes from a city far away. And then it will change their priorities when they see it, right? So if the Galileo Project finds a piece of equipment that came from another civilization that is real, and then it may motivate us to invest $1 trillion per year in this subject, figuring out where this car on the street came from and what it represents. And, you know, that's a huge sum of money. That's thousands of times more than the biggest science projects that were ever funded. And then we could, of course, build much bigger and better telescopes than the Galileo Project is planning. We can send probes to the cosmic neighborhood near us to figure out what else is out there. But it will have a huge impact on us. And I really think that for the better future of humanity, we should understand the neighborhood we live in. You know, the fact that we don't see a claim that we don't see neighbors, or that some people may hide this information in some way, that will not get rid of our neighbors. And so let's be brave and seek that evidence.
Avi, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I think that these conversations are extremely important as we progress our understanding of this issue. And I sincerely wish you and your team the very best with your mission going forward. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you so much. It was a very pleasant conversation. I really enjoyed it.